4. Measures. The verse line. True ease in writing comes from art, not chance, as those move easiest who have learned to dance. Alexander Pope, An Essay on Criticism, 1711. Poets die adolescents. Their beat embalms them. Robert Lowell, Fishnet, The Dolphin, 1973. Transcribing her husband's most famous poem, Mary Hutchinson Wordsworth, picked up her pen one day and wrote, "I wandered like a lonely." At this point, she stopped and realized her mistake. If we read aloud these two lines, "I wandered like a lonely cloud," and "I wandered lonely as a cloud," we will realize why she paused. Does not the first sound clumsy, awkward in the mouth and ear? In this small difference, we hear the essential importance of rhyme to poetry. In these two verses, the sentiment expressed is the same. The image used to convey it is the same, and the number of syllables and even the placing of the beats is the same. Nonetheless, and not only because of familiarity, "I wandered like a lonely" sounds wrong. Analytically, the reason must be that "like," though a vital part of speech, is too weak a word to bear a stress at this point in the impetus of the line. Putting it there delays the important idea of loneliness, especially as associated with the "I," whereas the stresses placed in "I wandered lonely" enabled the line to gather its meaning into the long and important syllable "lone," so that the line pivots upon it in both rhythm and meaning. But "I wandered like a lonely cloud" simply sags. The poetic line. What is often called poetic language is usually marked by a high incidence of imagery, metaphor, and the rich sounding of words. But these features might just as often be encountered in prose, which, for all its apparent flexibility, would in itself have to be described as a form. What most marks off poetry is the line. In chapter 2, we saw how the claps in the schoolyard rhyme, "When Susie Was," defined the verse. Each clap is a beat, and the beats are put together in lines. The rhythm, created in the line, is a sound in the head and the ear, and in written form, it becomes a defined space on a page. These lines of rhythm have been fundamental to the practice and concept of poetry, both as a mnemonic and a device working on the senses. Once more, we must recall poetry's oral roots. During its speaking, the way that the poem manipulates the time by development of pace, length of syllable, and emphasis, or beat, is decisive. These qualities comprise the cadence of the words. Cadence comes from Latin and Italian words meaning to fall, and this description, as when the wistful Orsino in Shakespeare's Twelfth Night says, "Of a song, it had a dying fall," Act 1, Scene 1, 4, is as often used of verse as of music. Under cadence, the Oxford English Dictionary quotes George Puttenham, writing in 1589 of "the fall of a verse in every last word, with a certain turnable sound, which being matched with another like sound, do make a concord." Poetry highlights the element of time and timing in how the particular sounds of words fall against each other, and so compose a concord, or pleasing harmony of sound. It is in this respect, of course, that poetry is closest to music, and both share such terms as rhythm and beat. It is here too that the question of whether poetry is sound or meaning is most accurate. Ezra Pound, 1885 to 1972, a poet who was also a composer, saw the different roles of words as musical concord, and words as items which carry meaning in a poem like this. The perception of the intellect is given in the word, that of the emotions in the cadence. This division may be simplistic, but it does address the experience of poetry in which we apprehend an idea and feel the same kind of sensuous surge that we derive from music at one and the same time. The principal means that poetry employs to create its particular cadences is the measure of the poetic line. The line gains its effect by recurrence, by the reappearance of notable features in the language time and again. It is the same principle that makes the chorus of a song its most important and memorable feature, the point where we can all join in. One way of creating recurrence in early English verse was to use alliteration, that is, to repeat the same consonant throughout a line, and as the line recurs to the left-hand side of the page or announces itself in the voice, it repeats the trick with another consonant. Swat, swarthy smiths, besmattered with smoke, drive me to death with din of their dints. The alliteration defines the line. Until 20th century explorations of free verse, lines usually recurred in the sense that their lengths and patterns had the same measure, or that the same measures recurred within reach of one another. Free verse will be considered in a later chapter, chapter 5. But here I am concerned with the working of the poetic line as it uses set measures or meters, which is often described as formal verse. Rhyme and meter. At this point, I should distinguish the term rhythm and meter, since they are often confused and used interchangeably. Rhythm refers to the way the sound of a poem moves in a general sense, either in part or through its whole length. Meter is more specific and refers to a set pattern which recurs line by line. Hickory dickory dock, the mouse ran up the clock. A free verse poem will not have a fixed measure like this, since measure is one of the things it seeks to be free of. But unless it is to be quite inert, it will have rhythm, as in these other varied lines from Lowell's Fishnet. The line must terminate, yet my heart rises. I know I've gladdened a lifetime, knotting, undoing a fishnet of tarred rope. The net will hang on the wall when the fish are eaten, nailed like illegible bronze on the futureless future. If we read these two examples aloud, one after the other, we will hear the regularity in the first and the irregular flow of the second. But the difference is not between a fixed tick-tock and a more liberated flow. A poem written in set measures will have a rhythmical movement of its own, which includes the effects of the measure, unless it is to sound tediously mechanical. The aim of this chapter is to describe the characteristics of set measures and then point to the ways in which their regularity varies to produce particular rhythmic effects. Different meters. Traditionally, these measures are made by one of four different systems, depending on what they count. They might count A, syllables, which is the segments of sounds that make up individual words, syllabics. B, quantity, that is the length of varying syllables, quantitative. C, beats, that is where the stress or accent falls on different syllables in normal speaking patterns, accentual or strong stress. And D, the number of stressed and unstressed syllables, often in an altering pattern. When a poem measures its lines by one or other of these systems, it is said to have meter, and the procedure for identifying and describing their working is scansion. In poetry in English, by far the most used of these meters is D, accentual or stress syllabic. However, because it is important to understand syllables and stress separately, I have placed accentual syllabic last in this series so that we can work towards it. Here is a fuller description of each of the four systems. Syllabics. The recognition of syllables is crucial to the composition and the study of formal measures. If we are to be absolutely precise, the syllable is difficult to define and is in part a concept as well as a concrete item. That we speak of putting something in words of one syllable suggests that that concept has to do with simplicity, of breaking things down to basics. But in the sounds of a language, the phoneme, not the syllable, is the most basic item. Phonemes are the sounds actually used by a particular language that will make a difference to the meaning of a word. Thus, if the phoneme, that is the K sound in cat, is replaced by the M phoneme, we have the entirely different meaning of mat. The number of different phonemes will vary according to the language, as will the permitted sounds. English has some 40-plus phonemes. There is a margin of variation in practice, some of which will not feature at all in other languages. For instance, the th sound, as in thin, is not a French phoneme, just as the Welsh f, as in fanefi, is not an English one. Our respective difficulties in pronouncing such sounds occur because they fall outside the phonological range we learn as children. A syllable, however, might be made up of a number of phonemes. K, a, t. Got to make up the single expressed voicing of cat. We do not articulate all its component sounds separately. K, a, t spells cat. But when we say katar, we must voice two separate sounds. Cat, r. For catapult, three. Cat-a-pult. For catamaran, four. Catamaran. The difficulty in precise definition comes from occasional doubt as to how many syllables a word has. For instance, an especially resonant actor might declaim, "Oh, for a muse of fire, that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention," in such a way as to give fire the two syllables many speakers, those with Welsh accents, for instance, would recognise anyway, even though Shakespeare only counts it as one. Similarly, many English North Country speakers might shorten pottery in a way that makes it sound like pottery. Within polysyllables, too, we might not always be sure where the divisions fall. Is it pol-e or po-ly? These are factors which make linguists pause before providing a suitably scientific definition of the syllable. What is especially important for poetry, however, is to recognise that different syllables have very different sounds and therefore contribute very different rhythmic qualities to speech. For instance, the briefly voiced syllable, a, sounds very different from the long-voweled fire. Tard is quite different from rope. We might go further than Kenneth Coke and say that not only does every word have a little music of its own, but that every syllable has too. Nevertheless, the sound feature we call the syllable, with the different sounds it can contain, is generally recognisable, and the number and the disposition of them are essential to all kinds of verse line. Since this is so, it might seem that the most obvious measure of a line is to count syllables. In fact, however, this method, syllabics, has not been much attempted in English poetry, because stress is so prominent a feature of spoken English that it is bound to become a dominant feature in any sequence. Where syllabics have been attempted, notably in the 20th century, they have often been employed specifically to disrupt the accentual expectations of the traditional line, by letting the stresses fall where they may. But then how do we distinguish a syllable-counted line as poetry from, say, the last 10 syllables of this sentence? We have seen already, in Chapter 1, that the haiku, adapted from the Japanese form, is constructed in lines counting syllables in the pattern of 5-7-5. This shaping is one way by which the distinction from consecutive prose is made. But a prose-like manner is likely to be an aim of syllabic verse, and may often emphasize this by eschewing the use of capital letters at the opening of new lines, in the way that poems conceived of as verses normally do. This is the first stanza of Considering the Snail by Tom Gunn, 1929-2004. The snail pushes through a green night, for the grass is heavy, with water and meats over the bright path he makes, where rain has darkened the earth's dark. He moves in a wood of desire. Careful counting will reveal that each of this poem's lines has 7 syllables. It seems as though Gunn is simply being contrary in imposing his chosen count in ways that break up the syntax. For example, separating green night and isolating the first word of a new sentence, he moves. In some other poems, he accompanies syllabics with rhyme. In Considering a Snail, there is the lightest of half rhymes, green rain, heavy he, over desire, which increases its difference from prose. But, as he has said in an interview subsequently, he was drawn to use syllabics as a way of changing the way he was writing. Because after you've been writing metrically for some years, you have that tune going in your head and you can't get rid of it, or when you try to write chopped-up prose. My way of teaching myself to write free verse was to work with syllabics. They aren't very interesting in themselves. They're really there for the sake of the writer rather than the reader. Gunn, 1993, page 219. Exactly what Gunn was trying to get rid of, we shall look at when we study stress syllable meters, and in Chapter 7, examining stanza form in a poem by Marianne Moore. We shall see just how much can be made of syllabics. Apparently the most crudely mechanistic of the ways to measure a line, it can be tooled to produce the most singular effects. Quantitative, the classical tradition. Quantitative measures were the principal way of making verse in Greek and Latin poetry. The measure depends upon the sound lengths, or quantity, of different syllables. Although the degree to which this followed in actual pronunciation is debated, and it may simply have become a convention. A line is defined by the number of syllables being divided into distinctive arrangements of long and short syllables. Heart, like tard, would be a long syllable, and hit, like rope, a short one. Educated in Latin and Greek, many European Renaissance poets of the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries composed poems in those classical languages and looked to those forms as ideal, both for reasons of prestige and out of an aesthetic liking for their complexity. Some tried to reproduce the quantitative method in verses in their own native languages. However, these have been only rarely successful, for certainly in English measuring quantities takes poets too far from the rhythms of the spoken language. The main reason now for readers of poetry in English to know anything of quantitative meter is because this long-standing devotion to the classical tradition has influenced the vocabulary used to describe verse measures. As we shall see later, scansion of lines that are in no way quantitative employs technical terms drawn from this classical tradition. It is useful to know the fundamentals of that terminology so that we can describe metrical features, when we encounter them. There are five principal types of metrical foot, and their names derive from Greek. Originally, a foot is a distinctive arrangement of short and long syllables. Types of quantitative poetic feet. 1. Iamb. One short and one long syllable, notated. 2. Spondi. Two long syllables, notated. 3. Trochi. One long and one short syllable, notated. 4. Dactyl. One long and two short syllables, notated. 5. Anapestic. Two short and one long syllable, notated. A classical quantitative line, therefore, made up of a set number of feet, the type depending upon the requirements of the poem. The conventional terms for these lengths of line are drawn from Latin. Lengths of quantitative line. Dimeter, 2 feet. Trimeter, 3 feet. Tetrameter, 4 feet. Pentameter, 5 feet. Hexameter, 6 feet. Hexameter, 6 feet. These terms, both for groupings of syllables and lengths of line, have been taken over in order to describe lines based upon stress, the main metrical feature of verse in English that we shall approach later. Instead of long and short syllables, English scansion has come to recognize stressed and unstressed syllables, with stress often marked and unstressed V. In subsequent quotations here, I have noted stressed syllables. Stress or accent. Stress or accent refers simply to the prominence some syllables have over others in speech. In some languages, Italian, for instance, where the stress falls is sometimes indicated by marked accents. Possibilità. Caffè. English rarely uses such marks except for words borrowed from other languages. But any English word of two or more syllables will be accented. Thus we say heaven, itself. Sometimes the same word, in different forms, will be stressed differently. For example, the noun is conflict, but the verb is conflict. The modulations here are not always exact. For instance, do we say syllable by stressing only sil and leaving ub and ul unstressed? Or do we put a lesser accent on the last to give sil abul? I think I would go for the former, but there are variations. Do we say distribute or distribute? Contribute or contribute? Some of these are much more marked, with different language groups providing quite different accents. English football fans will speak of United's defence, whereas American sports crowds chant defence, defence. In the English Midlands, the city is Birmingham, but in Alabama, it is usually Birmingham. Notwithstanding these differences, accent or stress is a prominent feature of English speech, and therefore of verse. In a sequence of monosyllabic words, some will be stressed more prominently than others, as in, we will be glad to send you cash. Usually the stress will be on the items most important for carrying the meaning with the grammatical items such as a, the, from, at, some, and suffixes like ed and ing being unaccented. When listening for stress in verse lines, it is helpful to think of that clapping song in chapter 1, when Susie was a baby. A baby Susie was. We clap on the stressed syllable. In some measured verse, stress is the main recurring feature. Why, Delilah? These are known as pure stress or strong stress meters. Besides their alliteration, those blacksmiths lean heavily on stress to create their recurrent effect. Swat swarthy smiths, besmattered with smoke, drive me to death with din of their dints. Here we have a preponderance of stressed syllables, in this case clearly aiming to mime the blows on the anvil. In other instances, the line will be defined by having a set number of stresses, two making it a dimeter, but ones that are strong enough to vault across two unstressed syllables. There was an old woman, and what do you think? She lived upon nothing but victuals and drink, victuals and drink. In another set pattern, these lines each have four stresses, making it a tetrameter, with a regular alternation of stressed and unstressed syllables. Half a pound of tuppenny rice, half a pound of treacle. Mix it up and make it nice. Pop goes the weasel. But in reciting, the rhyming words treacle and weasel are stretched to give two strong stresses as against their conventional values of treacle and weasel, thus emphasizing both the beat and the rhyme. Strong stress elements can be used for urgent purposes, as in Percy Bysshe Shelley's 1792-1822 indignant sonnet, England in 1819, which begins, "An old, mad, blind, despised, and dying king. Princes, the dregs of their dull race, who flow, through public scorn, mud from a muddy spring." These are 10-syllable lines, but what dominates them is the heavy hitting of certain clustered syllables, as in, "an old, mad, blind." However, the most used formal line in English poetry is one that employs a set pattern of stressed and unstressed syllables. Patterned stress. Patterned stress, or, as they are sometimes known, accentual syllabic or stress syllable meters, may vary in length of lines, but have a set number of syllables and a set number of stresses. Most often they will alternate, like this opening of Shakespeare's Sonnet 12. "When I do count, the clock that tells the time." Or from Sonnet 9, "Is it for fear to wet a widow's eye that thou consumest thyself in single life?" Each of these lines has 10 syllables, and each stresses them, alternatingly, in the pattern of titum, 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 titum. If we devise a slightly different version of that first line, still using just 10 syllables, "When I count the clock's strokes to tell the time," we don't have the same pattern. Scanned, it might sound like this: "When I count the clock's strokes to tell the time," which sounds simply clumsy and certainly has none of the regular measure of the clock's ticking, with its implications of relentlessness. This alternating duple pattern is predominant in verse in English. Why this might be so is a complex and fraught matter, which has long divided scholars. In essence, the argument is how far, if at all, the artifice of patterned stress meters is derived from the cadences of natural speech. Certainly, as the Princeton Encyclopedia of Poetry and Poetics points out, it is easy to fall into this binary, on-off pattern in such sentences as, "I'll have a whopper and a can of Coke." In another example, does the common expression "free and easy" rather than "easy and free" result from a deeply imbued preference to keep stressed syllables close to each other, i.e. "free and easy," not "easy and free"? "Bright and shining" rather than "shining and bright"? This is a fascinating area for further study, but requires too much complex linguistic discussion for our present purpose. The patterned stress lines are called iambic pentameter, a term composed from the classical vocabulary referred to earlier. This means that they consist of 5 feet, hence pentameter, each of which is a pairing of unstressed and stressed syllables, tidum, which are known as iambs. This line pattern is the fundamental basis for all of Shakespeare's sonnets, and the staple too of stage speech in his and his contemporaries' plays in Elizabethan theatre. Indeed, it is the most common formal measure in English verse. But as soon as I assert this, I must qualify it by saying that iambic patterns are in practice subject to a lot of variation, and if we were to scan strictly to a titum-titum pattern, we should have to stress syllables in ways that deform natural speech, as in this line from Shakespeare's sonnet 18, "Thou art more lovely and more temperate." The pattern, strictly applied, requires a stress on that last syllable, et. But few nowadays would articulate it. I shall discuss the properties and history of the iambic pentameter, and by extension other metrical lines, in ways that will emphasize the importance of variation, in more detail later in this chapter. What the basic pattern does is act as a real but often intuited structure, which the practicing poet may vary but never violate. There are, however, a number of other measures. Iambic lines might be longer and stress 6 of their 12 syllables, making a hexameter, or, to take the name from the most standard French verse line, an alexandrine, like these translated from Pierre Corneille's Le Cid. No day of joy or triumph comes untouched by care, no pure content without some shadow in the soul. Occasionally it can be even longer, as in Robert Southwell's, circa 1561-95, The Burning Babe, "As I, in hoary winter's night, stood shivering in the snow, surprised I was with sudden heat that made my heart to glow." Such a long line, the number of syllables makes it a 14er, has generally been found hard to handle. A verse line needs attention, much as a washing line does. The longer stretches can sag into incoherence. But the 14er has another life in which it is split into 2 segments, in the pattern of 4 stresses and 3 stresses. This is also known as ballad meter, or common meter, that we met in Chapter 2, and is strongly associated with the oral tradition. The king sits in Dunferling, tun, drinking the blood-red wine. Or will I get a guide sailor to sail this ship of mine? Used independently, the 4-stress and the 3-stress lines are known as tetrameters and trimeters, respectively. Staying with iambic versions of these lines, here is Jane Cave, 1754-1813, speaking in the voice of her ladyship to good Mistress Dishclout, an understandably sulky kitchen maid. "And learn to know your fittest place is with the dishes and the grease." And Thomas Campion, 1567-1620, in Now Winter Nights Enlarge, "Much speech hath some defence, though beauty no remorse." Yet shorter lines such as the 2-meter, dimeter, or even a line with but 1 stress, are uncommon. But here is the 17th century poet Robert Herrick, 1591-1674, showing off his versatility to the senior poet Ben Jonson, 1572-1637, by devising a stanza that includes lines of 1 stress up to pentameter. Ah, Ben, say how or when shall we, thy guests, meet at those lyric feasts made at the sun, the dog, the triple tun, where we such clusters had, as made us nobly wild, not mad. And yet each verse of thine outdid the meat, outdid the frolic wine. We can note that not all of these lines are iambic. For example, meet at those lyric feasts, made at the sun, are lines that both begin with a stressed syllable. In this pub-crawling poem, these interject some cheerful impetus by striking into the line without delay. The metrical foot composed of a stressed syllable followed by an unstressed syllable, tum di, is called a trochee, and thus the measure made of these feet is trochaic. The tale of Simple Simon's encounter is mostly trochaic. Simple Simon met a pieman going to the fair. Said Simple Simon to the pieman, "Let me taste your ware." Trochaic meters, because of their incipient stress, are often used for poems with an urgent tone, sometimes to exhort someone, especially at the beginning. This is often true of hymns, such as "Praise we the Lord, brightly did the light divine." "Christ will gather in his own to the place where he has gone, where our heart and treasure lie, where our life is hid on high." This is a four-beat measure, making the lines trochaic tetrameters. But as Herrick's lines have shown, trochaic feet can be used in other lengths of line. Trochaic measures tend to draw attention to the verse's metricality, marking it off very clearly from ordinary speech. Edgar Allan Poe, 1809-49, wanted poetry to have a mesmeric quality, which carries the reader in a nearly musical reverie, blurring the meaning of the words. Thus, he makes bold use of alliteration, rhyme, repetition, and emphatic meters. In The Raven, he employs an 8-stress trochaic line. "While I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly, there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door." However, we can note that these very long lines actually have a decided break in the middle. "As of someone gently rapping at my chamber door." Such a break is called a caesura, from the Latin meaning cut, and is a feature we shall meet elsewhere. We might think that the lines are really combined tetrameters, but elsewhere in the poem we can see that Poe wants the full continuous effect of the longer line. "Ah, distinctly I remember, it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor." Besides the iambic and the trochaic feet, there are two other less common meters that employ not two, but 3 syllables. These are the diactyl, which goes tum dt, and the anapest, which goes tt tum. This American's spiritual refrain uses the diactyl, "Steal away, steal away, steal away to Jesus." As does Alfred Lord Tennyson, 1809-92, in The Charge of the Light Brigade, "Flashed all their sabres bare, flashed as they turned in air." The anapest, by contrast, delays the stress, as in this anonymous tale of an Australian courtship. "But I got into trouble that very same night. Being drunk in the street, I got into a fight. A constable seized me, I gave him a box, and was put in the watch house and then in the stocks." In lines like these, the effect is to strengthen the stress, and so give the line a bouncing effect suitable to its knockabout subject matter. In longer lines, the anapest can evoke languor, as here in Hymn to Proserpine by Algernon Charles Swinburne, 1837 to 1909, where the delayed stress falls on a series of long vowels. Thou art more than the day or the morrow, the seasons that laugh or that weep. The beat can also be delayed for stirring purposes, as in Julia Ward Howe's 1819 to 1910 Battle Hymn of the Republic, which begins many of its lines with anapaests. He is trampling, he hath loosened, I have read, and in the beauty. The famous first line is, however, iambic. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. Though it is possible that scanning it this way is influenced by the marching beat of the tune, which is now inseparable from these lines. Might Howe have meant to record a visionary moment, to exclaim in her eagerness, mine eyes have seen, could give us a more nearly anapestic line, where the stresses are all on the most semantically important syllables. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. This would make the line closer in measure to those that follow, which after their opening anapests mostly put three unstressed syllables between each decided beat. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Alternatively, some might read these lines as a type of iambic, where the two unstressed syllables, as in he has, constitute one rhythmic beat. These possible variations take us back to a previous point and underscore what it is, an unavoidable experience when we seek to scan lines. Regular measure is not absolute and fixed, and indeed is not wholly regular, even in ostensibly regular poems. Crucially, for instance, whilst we distinguish between stressed and unstressed syllables, that simple divide does not take account of the different weights of stress that we might hear. Returning to Howe's opening line, we might easily hear a stronger beat on some of the stressed syllables. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. If this is how we hear the line, instead of the regular alternation of the first way that we scanned it, we could say we are giving greater stress to the beats in eyes, glor, com, and Lord than to the others. Alternatively, we might say that the line really only has those four beats, and that it bounds from one stress to the next across three unstressed syllables. This would mean that the line is less like the regular alternation of iambics and more similar to the strong stress line we looked at earlier. All of this points to the obvious fact that the possible variation within a metrical scheme shows us how crude the simple stress, unstressed analysis of a line is. There are arguably many gradations of possible stress, several in even a single line. Some readers have tried to introduce a calibrated system, which would give a value to each syllable ranging, say, from 1 to 4, according to the strength of the beat. This might give us mine, 2, eyes, 3, have, 1, seen, 3, the, 1, glory, 4, of, 2, the, 1, come, 3, ing, 1, of, 2, the, 1, Lord, 4. But here we are approaching the absurd. Scansion is not an exact science, and very few of us, I think, would want to read poetry in this way. Even a regular line such as, when I do count the clock that tells the time, whose metronomic alternation mimes the movement of a clock, is not in practice read so robotically. It does, however, draw attention to the degrees of stress that any individual reading aloud is going to make, and to the amount of variation in formal measures. But it does amount to prescription of how to read. Variation in practice. This brings us to a vital insight. I have referred to variation of the underlying structure of the metrical line, including the iambic pentameter. The purpose of acquiring the technical expertise to scan metrical lines is not so that we dutifully anatomize every line we read. Some knowledge of these technicalities provides us with the means to describe the general rhythmic pattern of a poem by informing our own listening. Most importantly, it helps us to notice and describe the significant moments where that pattern varies. Almost always, such shifts in the pattern are the most important moments. Even in metrical verse, rhythm is always a more important concept than meter. Shakespeare's Sonnet 94 is about nice, controlled people, but nonetheless is pregnant throughout with indignation. It begins with praise, but praise that is guarded, and the guardedness is implied in the opening line's irregularity. They that have power to hurt, and will do none. The stress on the first syllable, they, an inversion from the normal V, of the iamb to the trochee, V, suggests a finger being pointed, and the further effect of this is to leave that have unstressed, and so give the pivotal word power a very strong beat, one that is equaled by the next stress, hurt. Power to hurt is the poem's subject, and the two words are the fulcrum on which the first line is balanced. However, if we were to hear a beat on do at the end of the line, thus giving us three consecutive stresses, then the line does come weighted at that end. So far, such an emphasis might be thought of either as a confirmation of the virtue of they, or as a gathering irony, that they might not be all they seem. This impression is strengthened at line 5 with another opening stress on they, doubled by the immediate stress on the second syllable. They rightly are the lords and owners of their faces. The line has the regulation 5 stresses of the iambic pentameter, but is irregular in having 13 syllables. This matters not at all, since the important effect is to enlarge a sense of possible disgust should these lords and owners turn out less virtuous than their faces show. The disgust ignites finally as the last line flares with sudden rage. For sweetest things turn sourest by their deeds. Lilies that fester smell far worse than weeds. The even tone of the regular for sweetest is transformed by the force of the trochaic inversion, which makes the beat on the first syllable of lilies so emphatic. Of course, the image of rotting lilies is immensely powerful, but it is the variation of the measure which embodies the emotion in the poem. Most often, rhythmic effects work across several lines. Here is Christopher Marlowe's 1564-93, Dr. Faustus, lamenting that he has the individual immortal soul that is about to be claimed by hellfire. Or why is this immortal that thou hast? Ah, Pythagoras, metempsychosis, were that true, this soul should fly from me and be changed unto some brutish beast. All beasts are happy, for when they die, their souls are soon dissolved in elements. Now the basic measure of Dr. Faustus is iambic pentameter, but looking for regularity in these lines, I am soon at sea. Line 1 is regular, though that cannot carry the same pronounced weight as immortal. Line 4 is nearly so, but for the weak ending on an unstressed syllable, happy. The real interest lies elsewhere, in the effects created by the long second line, which seems to me impossible to scan conventionally, but is a gift to an actor in its rolling out the syllables of that impressive-sounding phrase. Pythagoras. Metempsychosis. From there, the line runs on in a sequence that, allowing for the midline pause at brutish beast, joins together, enjambment, five lines, including the simple change of key, enabled by the very short, for when they die. In the final line, the drawn-out sound of dissolved means that the line does not need the normal fifth stress as it mimes Faustus's longing. Marlowe, like many other poets, is using a measure and playing changes upon it to create the particular rhythms he needs for his meaning. Sometimes, such variations will be yet more obvious, as in the remarkable inventiveness of John Donne's Song and Sonnets. There, he devises stanza forms, which combine pentameter, tetrameter, trimeter, and complete irregularity. Consider his love poem, The Sun Rising. She's all states and all princes. I, nothing else is. Princes do but play us, compared to this, all honours mimic, all wealth alchemy. Any attempt to scan this metrically will very likely confuse us, but the lover's defiant exultation is marvellously carried in the rhythmic boldness of the staccato and surging effect. Later, 18th century critics could not stomach Donne's free-handed way with formal metres, and it is significant that the revival of interest in his work and that of his Jacobean contemporaries, including the dramatists, did not take place until the early 20th century and the beginnings of the free verse movement. T.S. Eliot, 1888 to 1965, was central to that movement, though he claimed emphatically that it did not exist. But what Eliot did insist is that the very life of verse is the contrast between fixity and flux. By this, he meant that successful verse lines do not continue to repeat an established pattern as exactly as possible, but operate in relation to it. In his essay, Reflections on Vers Libre, 1917, he wrote, "The most interesting verse that has yet been written in our language has been done either by taking a very simple form, like the iambic pentameter, and constantly withdrawing from it, or taking no form at all, and constantly approximating to a very simple one." It is as though the simple form radiates a force field within which the poet works, sometimes closer to the exact pattern, sometimes further away. Attending to set measures, therefore, for the reader as for the poet, is not a matter of slavish notation, but of sensing variation, the tension between fixity and flux. It was Eliot, too, who coined the phrase the auditory imagination, by which he meant the feeling for syllable and rhythm, penetrating far below conscious levels of thought and feeling, invigorating every word. It is this auditory imagination that we exercise and develop as we read poetry. Knowledge of the technicalities of scansion should increase our awareness as we read and give us the means to understand quite how a rhythmic effect is being produced. But if such knowledge is elevated into an exclusive mystery tasseled with Greek terminology, it is serving neither the reader nor poetry. The knowledge should enrich, not replace reading, that is to say, hearing. In the noise of words and the rhythms of their combinations, we hear all the complex accumulations of meaning with which, in all areas, we try to make ourselves understood. Measure, an historical overview. The history of measure in poetry in English is not only a matter of technical description. The changes in the style of the line are also a matter of culture and relate first to the history of the British Isles and later to the English-speaking world at large. In this part of this chapter, I want to revisit the measures outlined earlier, but in a chronological way that connects them to linguistic and cultural change. English medieval poetry moved through a varied series of metrical forms, especially in the latter part of the period. In Old English, the Anglo-Saxon verse line was not only heavily accented, usually, as in the 8th century epic Beowulf, a pure stress line of four accents, but also alliterated and with a midline caesura. This pattern helped both reciter and audience as the poem was performed aloud. The lines tended also to be self-contained and sequential rather than carrying the sense fluidly through a long run of lines. In the Middle English period, roughly the time between the Norman conquest in 1066 and the rise of printing at the end of the 1400s, the language underwent considerable change. To look at a page of Old English is to see, in effect, a foreign language, whereas Chaucer, though unfamiliar, is at the least recognisable to the modern reader. One important change was in syntax. Old English, like Latin and like German, is an inflected language. That is, the forms of certain words change according to their exact role in the meaning of a sentence. Because a verb ending, for instance, includes the information of what its subject and tense are, the verb can be variously placed within a sentence and still make the necessary connections. In Old English, verbs commonly come at the end of a clause or sentence, as in this line from the poem Seafarer.
Bitre, briostker, gebiden, hoper.
The most literal translation of this might be, bitter the cares in my breast, I have abided. With the I inserted, because it had occurred in the original several lines earlier. Using modern English syntax, we might have, I have endured the most bitter anxiety. Such a change in syntax clearly altered how a poet will order the space of the line. But the change has another significance for poetry. When a poet reverts to the inversion of subject and verb in the manner of Old English, this is especially noticeable and becomes foregrounded as a gestural feature in itself. When Susie was a baby Susie was. When Ezra Pound wrote his 20th century version of The Seafarer, he wanted to keep a sense of the original and gave a shock to what he felt had become stale modern usage. Therefore, using a version of Anglo-Saxon strong stress metre, he compressed it and inverts, bitter breast cares have I abided. Both in this chapter and chapter 5 on free verse, we shall explore further this tendency to make something new through going back to the old. A second new influence, felt particularly in vocabulary, was the absorption of the Romance languages, Latin, Italian, and especially French, following the Norman conquest of 1066. Metrics in the later Middle Ages, roughly 1300 to 1500, became more various. The four-stressed, Old English line continues in works like Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and, as we see here in William Langland's 1331 to 1400, Piers Plowman, although the caesura, becomes less evident. In a summer season, wan soft was the sun. I shope me in shrouds as I a sheep were. But in the same period, the ballad, or common metre, flourished with its 4-3 stress pattern, a measure also employed in the carol, originally a dance song with a refrain. As I lay upon a night, alone in my longing, methought I saw a wonder sight, a maiden child rocking. This example from the 14th century is also counting syllables to form an alternating pattern, as does this other verse from the same period, where we can hear a virtually regular stress syllable tetrameter. Jesus Christ, my lemon sweet, beloved, that didst on the road tree, rude cross, with all my might, I thee beseech, for thy wounds two and three. Chaucer was certainly writing patterned stress tetrameter in his early Romance of the Rose. Full gay was all the ground, and quaint, and powdered as men had it paint, with many a fresh and sundry flower, that casten up full good savour. Savour, one of the many, many French words that came into English at this time, will have been stressed as savour. Chaucer was well acquainted with French poetry, and introduced new forms like the rondieu into English, and it was probably with influence from this source that he came to lengthen his line to 10 syllables, decasyllabic, and to stress 5 of them, thus working it into iambic pentameter, as in these lines from the Pardoner's prologue in his The Canterbury Tales. For I wall preach and beg in sundry lands. I wall not do no labour with mine hands. Chaucer's iambic pentameter did not, however, immediately dominate English metres. Between 1400 and the mid-16th century, poets were, if anything, yet more eclectic in their choice of line forms. But there were several influences at work that eventually consolidated English measures and other aspects of poetic form in the 16th century. The first of these had to do with the development of the language and the attitude towards it among the literate classes. The 14th and 15th centuries saw an accelerated standardization of the language around the version of English that included the dominant city of London. Vocabulary, usage, and spelling became much closer to what we can recognize as modern English, and the development of printing in the 1400s and early 1600s carried this standardization more and more widely. At the same time, the official dominance and prestige of Latin and French, dating back to the Roman Empire and the Norman Conquest, began to decline among the English-educated classes. Increasingly, they became interested and committed to their own language as a valued medium of literature, as opposed to common or vernacular communication. Yet, like Chaucer, this elite was multilingual and open to continental influence to a greater degree than at any time since. So, for instance, Sir Thomas Wyatt, 1503-42, and Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey, 1517-47, in the early and mid-16th century, imitated the forms, including the sonnet they came to know mainly from the Italian poet Petrarch, 1304-74, and fashioned the long Italian line into English decasyllables. They were educated in the Greek and Latin classics, as they had been recovered during the Renaissance, and this classism provided them with a self-conscious interest in prosody and metrics, which could act as a theoretical framework for their experiments in poetry. One result of this was the development of scansion, using the classical terminology I described earlier. In some ways, what was happening was that English poetry was being civilized out of its earlier rough and rude habits by the exercise of sophisticated continental models that appealed to the courtier poets. Thomas Campion, 1567-1620, for instance, urged quantitative metrics on English poetry so that it might have the honor
to be the first that, after so many years of barbarism, could second the perfection of the industrious Greeks and Romans. Practice, including Campion's own, was happily different, and, despite the self-consciousness of poetic theory, English verse in the Tudor 1500s continued to be pragmatically irregular, indeed all but barbarous, as the later, more determinedly classical, imitators and critics of the 18th century later found it to be. The special case, iambic pentameter. But we should pause at the iambic pentameter, because it did become the single most salient and influential of English measures. It is the line of the Tudor sonnet tradition, and most significantly, of the Elizabethan and Jacobean verse drama of the late 1500s and early 1600s. Later, Milton employs it in Paradise Lost, and returning to a rhyming form, it is the basis of the heroic couplet of the 18th century. Wordsworth and other romantic poets used it extensively, and it has continued to figure in verse in English up to our own day. The reasons why the iambic pentameter became and remained so dominant are far from simple to determine. For a long time, it was claimed that it is the meter most natural to English speech rhythms, and the instances of iambs in speech alluded to earlier give some credence to this. We might occasionally catch someone saying, "He works at Mr. Minute down the street," or "You'll never see a team as good as Stoke," or even, "Another losing season for the Jets." But this argument must be difficult to prove linguistically. It also begs the question of what was natural to English speech rhythms when strong stress patterns were dominant in English verse. The argument would have to depend on establishing a distinct change in English speech patterns in the later Middle Ages, as the Old English inheritance shifted into early modern English. Alternative theories emphasize the artifice rather than the naturalness of the verse line, and relate the development of the iambic pentameter to social and cultural change. Thus, its channeling through the work of a cosmopolitan courtly elite might be seen as the process of smoothing the crude stresses of the traditional English verse line into an equable alternation of tone more acceptable to an urbane ruling class, seeking to ease itself away culturally from the populace and their vulgar verses. The role of poetry in the sophisticated play of the courtly love tradition of Renaissance courts, and the emphasis given to this in literary history, certainly aids this impression. An instance of such socio-cultural division might be the scene at the end of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, where the thumping, versifying of the rude mechanicals play, though most of it is in iambic pentameter, is mocked by the aristocratic audience. But such a theory also needs to consider the Renaissance enthusiasm for the vernacular among a ruling group, who, by their privileged access to Latin and French, had been able to set themselves culturally apart from the people for centuries. Moreover, if the literate elites were so keen to maintain their cultural superiority, they might have been expected to foster a more regular and classically inspired metric than the iambic pentameter proved to be. In practice, the iambic pentameter became an extremely flexible instrument, especially in the dramatic speech of the growingly popular Elizabethan stage. It could meet the demands of sounding plausibly like real people speaking, a demand that led to the abandonment of endless alliteration and rhyme in favour of blank verse. whilst retaining the capacity for high-flown rhetoric. It can be fluent and continuous, or set and reiterative as required. It possesses the capacity to move between fixity and flux, as Eliot noted. So, to better understand its success, we need to look further into its technicalities. We might ask two questions. Why is it iambic? And why is it a pentameter? In musical terms, the sequence of unstressed syllable followed by stressed syllable, ti-dum, can be described as a rising rhythm. What are the implications of basing a measure on this impetus? The linguist, Otto Jespersen, in his 1933 essay, Notes on Meter, made this suggestion. As a stressed syllable tends, other things being equal, to be pronounced with higher pitch than weak syllables, a purely iambic line will tend towards a higher tone at the end. But according to general phonetic laws, this is a sign that something more is to be expected. Consequently, it is in iambic verses easy to knit line to line in natural continuation. Encyclopaedia Britannica, Prosody, 20th century. Following Jespersen's proposal, iambic meter aids verse which seeks to emphasize continuity. The argument of a sonnet, with its frequently elaborate syntax, or the real speech of characters in a drama, both need this kind of continuity. A sense of closure, as Jespersen remarks, can be brought about by consecutive rhyming, as in the couplet that closes the sonnet or scenes in Elizabethan drama. This kind of continuity, where the reader's expectancy is carried along by a developing syntax that crosses the verse line, is well exemplified in Shakespeare's sonnet 140. Be wise as thou art cruel. Do not press my tongue-tied patience with too much disdain, lest sorrow lead me words and words express the manner of my pity wanting pain. The lines where the sense runs on without pause across the line break, enjambment, do not press my tongue-tied patience, show in particular how the stress on the last syllable of each line carries us forward to the next stage of the statement. We can also see that while the first two lines can be readily measured out as conventional iambics, it is more likely that we will read them aloud for the sense, with a very different sequence of stresses. Be wise, as thou art cruel, do not press my tongue-tied patience with too much disdain. Again, we see the basis of the regular measure acting as underlying pattern to enable particular variation. The opening of Sonnet 91 presents a quite different effect. Some glory in their birth, some in their skill, some in their wealth, some in their body's force, some in their garments, though newfangled ill, some in their hawks and hounds, some in their horse. The first words might be read conventionally, some glory, or, for greater attack, by stressing both opening syllables, some glory. The following three certainly demand a stress on the opening syllable, some in their wealth. The movement here is not based on syntactical continuity in the manner of Sonnet 140, but on parallel repetitions. For the required emphasis, the stress pattern is reversed from the iambic ti-dum to give a trochaic foot, dum-di. As we have seen with Simple Simon, a strong trochaic presence seems to fit the manner of emphatic repetition. An entirely trochaic meter tends towards the closure of every line and to require constant repetition to move the poem along. Longfellow's Hiawatha, written in trochaic tetrameter, is a famous example. By the shores of Gichigumi, by the shining big sea water, stood the wigwam of Nokomis, daughter of the moon, Nokomis. The trochaic meter lays each line down in a fixed fashion, often inverting subject and verb. Stood the wigwam, rose the firs. Drawing attention to the verse's artifice. There is, though, a limited call for the matter, and so a technical answer as to why verse, since the 16th century, has been mainly iambic, may be because the rising rhythm assists the continuity of speech in dramatic poetry, and the fluency of thought and argument in much lyric poetry. Now, what of the pentameter half of the term? The line's length? Why are 10 syllables divided iambically? We have looked at different lengths of line, and of the difficulty of sustaining long lines without the tendency to fall into two. We can hear this happening in these fortines from Arthur Golding's 1567 translation of the Roman poet Ovid. Then sprang up first the golden age, which of itself maintained the true and right of everything, unforced and unconstrained. But a longish line does clearly assist fluency and continuity. So how did the 10-syllable line achieve such popularity? One theory points not to a decisive break between the longer line of medieval verse and the succeeding pentameter, but to the things they have in common. The longer line tended to spring its stresses across 10 and frequently more syllables. But as Middle English modulated into early modern English, there was a greater reduction of inflections and subsequently many syllables ceased to be sounded. For example, that terminal E, as in the legendary Ye Old English Tea Shop, now resurrected for tourists. Basil Cottle, in his book The Triumph of English, 1350 to 1400, compares the sentence, "The good lads went in fast to the Blake Hill," which in Chaucer's day would have sounded each E and amounted to 15 syllables, with its modern equivalent, "The good lads went fast to the Black Hill," a total of only 9 syllables. Following this suggestion, we might recognise a tendency for the medieval line of 12 or 14 syllables to become a line nearer to 10, as the spoken language changed. Nonetheless, there is a decisive difference between 4 and 5 beat lines. As an even number, 4 can readily be split into 2 even parts. When allied with rhyme, there is another binary, and overall, we have a highly structured verse form, most evident in the quatrain, as in the ballad, "The King Sits in Dunferling Tunney." We looked at earlier in this chapter. Even when the syntax does not require even a slight midline pause, caesura, we can perceive the seesaw rhythm. This is Puck, a figure from the folk world, speaking at the end of A Midsummer Night's Dream. "If we shadows have offended, think but this, and all is mended, that you have but slumbered here, while these visions did appear, and this weak and idle theme, no more yielding but a dream. Gentles, do not reprehend. If you pardon, we will mend." Now, for many purposes, this degree of a sensible, nearly symmetrical balance has attraction and virtue, but the 5-beat line, which cannot be divided into rhythmically even portions, offers the possibility of escaping the firmness of this structure to towards a greater fluency. It is not so long as to become unwieldy in the mouth, but long enough to enable greater discursiveness. Culturally, for the learned poets of the English 16th century, it is the advantage of approximating the classical meters of Greece and Rome and the model of Italian verse, as well as sounding quite unlike the rude popular tradition, especially in his early comedies, The Dream and the Lover's Labour's Lost. Shakespeare employs and parodies both these registers. Thus, did poetry in early modern English shed the 4B line, along with older devices such as alliteration and the regular caesura, so as to achieve a verse that could mime actual speech, whilst still keeping a measure elevated enough for rhetorical power. In evolving the decasyllabic line, it also extended the range of its stress base, and thus its flexibility. Here is one final idea about the character of the iambic pentameter. In an intriguing essay called The Dimension of the Present Moment, the Czech poet and scientist Miroslav Holub, 1923-98, writes that while he can imagine eternity, he finds great difficulty in figuring the present moment. In a series of swift, light-footed speculations, he draws upon experimental psychology and musical data to propose that, in our consciousness, the present moment lasts about 3 seconds, with small individual differences. The Dimension of the Present Moment, 1990, page 1. This disarmingly simple notion, he then allies with studies of the poetic line in a number of different languages, with the broad conclusion that the outer edge of momentary attention at 3 to 4 seconds corresponds to the normal limit of a 10-syllable poetic line. We do not have to attach ourselves strongly to the science of these ideas to feel their possibilities. The neural effects of how we hear the rhythm and length of a line seem close to how we apprehend. As we have seen, the analysis of measured verse can be quite complex. It would be much more difficult to understand how, within the processes of evolution, the first human speech for record and reiteration depended upon the recurrence of what we now call the poetic line. Nonetheless, it is in the simple clap of the hand, the tap of the foot, that these metrical patterns have their foundation. Summary. In this chapter on formal verse, we have examined the poetic line and the importance of rhythm, beat, and cadence, the distinction between rhyme and meter, the four main classifications of formal meters, syllabics, quantitative, accentual, and patterned stress, the terminology and method of scansions, the importance of variation, breaking the rules of meter, the historical development of meter in English poetry, with special reference to the iambic pentameter.